But living down here in South Florida, I imagine that almost everyone here probably has some relationship to the ocean. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to travel down with some friends to the Florida Keys. Now, me being from Canada, I can tell you that was beautiful. The plan was that we were going to go and go snorkeling. So, you know, our friend had a boat, so we were out on the ocean, crystal clear water, and we got the snorkeling gear on. I had never done it in my whole life. So we got in there, and turns out I'm no good at snorkeling. We got to see some beautiful fish. I will tell you, the crystal clear water allowed us to see some beautiful fish, but 15 minutes later, I had had my fill of snorkeling, metaphorically, and my fill of salt water, literally. It was an experience. But that got me thinking, how can these fish, right, that honestly taste so delicious, right, if you ever had fish, how can these fish that taste so delicious live in an environment that is so salty? You ever thought about that? Because they spend their whole lives in the icky, nasty salt water, and then you pull them out of the ocean, fry them up, and then you have to add your own spices, right? How is that? How does that happen? Well, turns out there's actually a number of different ways that that's accomplished, but I just want to mention one. Take the tuna fish, for example. The tuna fish spends its whole life in the salt water, but what happens is, as it drinks in that salt water for hydration, as the salt is kind of extracted, it gets caught up in the kidneys, and the kidneys are specially designed to filter out that extra salt water. So when you catch it, it's not salty. See, the fish live in the salt water and yet are themselves not salty. The reason that I bring that up, the reason that we go through all of that, is we, as Christians, live in this world full of sin. And yet, we are called to live lives that are not stained with sin. This is the sentiment that was expressed by Jesus in John chapter 17. John 17, starting in verse 14, Jesus said, "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one." They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Generally speaking, then, we as Christians live in the world, but are not to be of the world. More specifically, tonight, we want to talk about living in an Amazon Prime world. And let me make this disclaimer now, so I won't have to make it later. There is nothing inherently sinful about Amazon Prime. I am currently on my free trial for Amazon Prime, so it's not inherently sinful. However, insofar as Amazon Prime caters to the demands of society, it is a good thermostat, if you will, to gauge where society is at and the problems that we are experiencing. So, with that understanding, I want to suggest about four elements of this Amazon Prime world, this society of Amazon Prime, that we need to address this evening. So how can we resist this Amazon Prime mentality? The first suggestion that I would make is that we ought to resist the Amazon Prime mentality by filtering out materialism. And let's first begin by defining what we mean. What is this problem of materialism? Materialism is when your primary goal or your measure of success is the acquisition, the acquiring of money and possessions. That's your goal, your focus, your measure of success. And that's exactly opposite to what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, where he said, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures in heaven," or "store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal." In contrast to that, He cautioned us not to store up treasures on earth, where moth and rust do destroy, and thieves do break in and steal. See, this problem of storing up treasures on earth is not a new one, but it has been sweeping across the Western world for maybe a century, several centuries, and is even now in the Eastern world. Just to give you a taste of what this entails, back in 2001, this book was published, or a book was published, and it referenced a survey. Here's what the survey found. It found that 7% of Americans said that they would murder someone for $3 million. Imagine that, right? 7%. How many people do you know? 7%. Okay. But it also found that 65% said that they would spend a year on a desert island in order to earn $1 million. 1 year on a desert island for $1 million. In the 1940s, 40% of students said that the primary reason for them going to college was to earn money. Okay, so 40% of students, primary reason was to earn money. By the late 1990s, that figure had jumped up to 75%. And you might think, okay, well, that doesn't sound too bad. It could be worse, and you would be correct, because it is worse. Over the past 50 years, the average American home has tripled in size. Tripled. In addition, one out of every 10 Americans rents off-site storage. So the home has tripled in size, and one in 10 now rent off-site storage. Further, the off-site storage industry has been the fastest growing market within commercial real estate for the past 4 decades. The fastest growing market in commercial real estate is where people store their stuff. It gets worse. Even with all of that storage, half of the people who own 2-car garages cannot park their cars in their garages because it's packed with stuff, right? The average American home spends $1,700 on clothing annually. And yet, they throw away 65 pounds of clothing annually. Our homes, on average, now have more televisions than people inside of them. I did a quick search on Amazon just to kind of get a sense of what people were buying with their Amazon Prime memberships. And here was part of the list of the best sellers, the bestseller items. It's things like an inflatable lounge pool, an LOL Surprise Glam Glitter Doll, Amazon's Echo Dot with Alexa, gaming headsets with built-in microphones, PlayStation Store gift cards, quick dry Aqua yoga socks, and Fire Stick TVs, which allow you to access platforms like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime Video and all of those different things. Now, hear me on this. We are foolish if we think that us as the church, specifically down here in South Florida, are immune to this problem of materialism. We're foolish if we think that. So, how do we identify materialism? Because we can talk about it and how bad it is, but how do we identify materialism in our lives? Well, I was reading an article on ChristianityToday.com, and they had some suggested questions that you ask yourself. So just answer these questions for yourselves. Question number one, do you feel discontented with what you have in life right now? Do you feel discontented with what you have in life right now? Question number two, are you spending more than you're saving? In other words, your monthly income is this much, and your monthly outgo is that much. And if the balance is going down, then you're spending more than you're making. That was their second question. Question number three. Do you yearn to hoard money, even though you don't have a particular need for it? You hoard money even though you don't have a particular need for it. Think of the mythical dragons of old, right? What did they go around doing? They went around terrorizing villages, collecting gold coins, right, and all of this treasure to store it in their cave so they could do what with it? To kill anyone that tried to take it from them, and then eventually die on a big stack of gold stuff that was worthless to them, right? They just hoarded it, even though they didn't have a need for it. That's what they're saying here. You just hoard money because, I don't know, you just want it. Question number four. Do you find yourself cheating or wanting to cheat on your taxes so that you can get a better return? These are the kinds of things that would happen. Question number five. Have you used your credit card to purchase things that you don't have the money for? Use your credit card to purchase things you don't have money for. Question number six. This one's maybe my favorite. Do you feel uncomfortable when your preacher mentions money or finances? You might be materialistic. And let me tell you, for all of this, I'm sitting right there in the pew with you. I am no more immune to materialism than any of you are. So, what about a solution? Right? If we know it's a problem and we can identify it, what's the solution to materialism? And here I would suggest one possible solution. It's not the solution, but it's one possible solution. And that is generosity. Generosity. Consider this passage coming from Acts chapter 4, verse 32. The church is still in its infancy, and here was the general feeling in the church. Acts 4, verse 32, "And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonged to him that was his own, but all things were common property to them. And with great power, the apostles were giving testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and abundant grace was upon them all, for there was not a needy person among them. For all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales." Just think about that. Think about that in our society. We think that is crazy. For people to be owners of homes, owners of land, right? And for them to sell it, take the money from the proceeds, and give it to the church so that no one would be needy, so that the church could accomplish its work. That was the tenor of the first century church. Or what about Acts 11? Where there was going to be a famine in Judea. And so the disciples in Antioch, according to their ability, gave money to the church at Jerusalem so that they could alleviate the needs. Or 2 Corinthians chapter 8, which talks about the Macedonian churches giving out of their poverty. Almost no one here, I believe, could be described as being in poverty. Here, the Macedonian churches, out of their poverty, were giving even beyond their ability so that they could help alleviate the disaster that was taking place in Jerusalem. In contrast, last year, the average churchgoer gave 2.5% of their income to churches. Now, that's not the Lord's church specifically, that's Christendom. 2.5%. To put that into perspective, during the Great Depression, the average was 3.3%. So what am I saying? I'm saying that somewhere along the line, between the first century and the 21st century, materialism infected the church. And I'm saying that generosity is the cure. It's hard to make possessions and money your one goal if you keep giving them away. It's hard. Just imagine what the church could do if everyone on the first day of the week set aside some money in keeping with their income and gave according to their ability, some even beyond their ability. What could the church accomplish? What could this church accomplish if we were generous? See, the world of Amazon Prime is materialistic, but generosity helps to filter it out. But secondly, we can resist this Amazon Prime world, this Amazon Prime mentality, by filtering out society's need for immediate gratification. See, if I'm shopping on Amazon, and I have a choice between 2-day and 15-day shipping, which one am I going to pick, right? 2-day shipping every day, right? Because I want it right then. And if I don't want to pay for it, I can just pay for a $120 annual subscription to Amazon Prime and get free 2-day shipping. In some cases, you can even get 1-day shipping, and in certain parts of the country, you can get 2-hour shipping. The world we live in, right? Why do we have that? Well, because we want it when we want it, right? We make that click, we want it on our doorstep right then. To quote one Veruca Salt, I don't care how, I just want it now. All right, that's a little reference to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory if you missed that. But we do live in this world that demands immediate gratification. So what do we do about that? What's the solution to this kind of mindset? How do we overcome it? I would suggest that the solution to this desire for immediate gratification is patience. Now, I'll be frank with you. Here, I'm not telling you anything new. I know that. You know that. So how do we incorporate it? The reason that I'm bringing it up is because sometimes these infiltrations are so subtle that we don't recognize that they've happened until they have their grip on us so tightly that we realize we never saw it coming. So bear with me as I just call your attention to two passages that you're familiar with. The first one is 1 Corinthians 13, as Paul is masterfully describing Christian love. If you will recall from 1 Corinthians 13, he gives that list of characteristics, right? What's the very first characteristic that he gives of love? Love is patient. Patient. Aren't you thankful that God loves you? Aren't you thankful that God is patient with you? I know I'm glad he's patient with me. And we are called to reflect that patience to the world, not to be polluted by the world. Galatians 5:22, another very familiar passage. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience. This is a critical component of Christian living. So what is patience? How do we define patience? Patience is defined as remaining tranquil while awaiting an outcome. Remaining tranquil while awaiting an outcome. So, as you wait for various outcomes in your life, how tranquil are you? I mean, don't even get me started on slow Wi-Fi, all right? Who waits for YouTube videos to load anymore? 10 seconds and you're still buffering? I'm out. Right? We have this infiltration in our society. When you're at the store, how do you treat the clerk when things haven't gone your way? Right? Maybe he can't help you find what you're looking for. Maybe you're trying to return an item. Right? If you ever tried to return an item at Walmart, you need patience. What if you're trying to just get out of there, right? And you've got that clerk there, and she is scanning items at the blinding rate of one item per 5 seconds, right? Just boop. Boop. You need patience. Or the person in front of you pulls out their vintage collection of coupons, and you and I both know that they're expired, but she's got a check. Do you have patience? What about when you're at the restaurant, right? And the waiter or waitress can't get your order right. The food's taking forever. Maybe it's cold when it comes out. How do you treat them? Or perhaps you lack patience in finances. Or coming back to the credit card example, You don't have the patience to save up the money, so you just flash the plastic. Even though you didn't have the money for it, you wanted it right then. You couldn't remain tranquil when awaiting an outcome. And look, I know these are silly examples, but they're silly and they're simple for a reason. And it's because I don't want you to complicate it. I don't want you to complicate this idea of patience. See, patience isn't an event that occurs. Patience is a lifestyle that you live. Right? Patience is a lifestyle. So if there are areas in your life where you are not demonstrating patience, that's a reflection on your character. See, don't think of it as an event, but as a lifestyle. We live in this world of immediate gratification. We want it now, but we must not allow it to contaminate us. We must be patient. Thirdly, we resist the Amazon Prime mentality by filtering out the premium that our culture, our society places on comfort. Why do you suppose that online shopping has become so popular? It's because you can order anything and everything you want while sitting in your bed in your pajamas, right? That's the life. Did you know that you can now order meals on Amazon? If you have Amazon Prime, you can order your meals, you can order the silverware, the plates. You never have to leave your house ever again, right? It's this premium on comfort. We want to be comfortable all the time. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with being comfortable. We like comfortable clothes and comfortable shoes and cars. But once that starts to infiltrate, right, once that starts to become the priority, we start to see some problems. We get to the point where we don't want to interact with uncomfortable ideas. We get to the point where we don't want to have an uncomfortable conversation with someone. We get to the point where we don't even want to be around a person that makes us uncomfortable. Or maybe we don't even want to be around people at all, right? Just because it makes us uncomfortable. I don't need that in my life. So this problem of the priority that we tend to place on being comfortable shows up in the Christian life. What's the solution? How do we combat that? I don't like this answer. You probably won't like this answer. The solution to the premium that our society places on comfort is to start undergoing some trials. You may have heard that the preacher's job is to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted. Now, why is that? It's because, generally speaking, if you are completely comfortable with your life, chances are you're not living the Christian life, because the Christian life is not intended to be comfortable. Look at the life of Paul, right? Just look at Acts chapter 14, starting in verse 19. As Paul was on his first missionary journey, traveling along with Barnabas, Acts 14, starting in verse 19, but the Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, and having won over the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. Time out. Picture that in your mind. Here's Paul preaching and doing the Lord's work. The Jews come and stone him to the point where they think he's dead, and they drag what they think is his dead corpse out of the city. Then you continue reading, the disciples gathered around him. He got up. No indication of miraculous event here. He got up and went back into the city. Into the same city where the people are living, or had traveled to stone him. Then he continues on to the next city, Derbe. Then he decides that he's going to go back to the cities that he's visited, Lystra, Iconium, Antioch, strengthening the disciples. How much pain do you suppose Paul was in? It's not like he could just hop in the car. He's got to walk. After being stoned, how easy would it have been for Paul to prioritize comfort in that situation? super easy. I don't want to be stoned again. This is too hard. I'd rather be comfortable. And notice the message that he was giving to these disciples that he had just converted. He said, we must enter the kingdom through many trials. We must enter the kingdom through many trials. How easy would it have been for him to prioritize comfort? And here we are, enduring trials, and yet of much less severity. And how easy is it for us to prioritize comfort? You see, it's not comfortable to talk to other people about Jesus. It's not comfortable helping the poor. It's not comfortable confessing your sin or confronting a brother or sister who is living in sin. It's not comfortable visiting the sick and the bereaved. And yet that is what God calls us to do. We must reject society on this one. We must embrace the trials and reject the priority that our Amazon Prime world places on comfort. Finally, I would suggest that we resist the Amazon Prime mentality by filtering out society's offering of a free trial, no obligation cancellation policy. Now, you're saying, Aaron, what could possibly be wrong with a free trial, no cancellation obligation policy, right? Well, the answer is nothing is inherently wrong with that thing, right? You purchase a product and it wasn't meeting your needs, so what do? You go and return it. Nothing wrong with that. Maybe you sign up for a subscription-based service like Amazon Prime. They offer that 1 month free, right? It's not meeting your needs, right? It's not really providing the value that you thought it would, so you cancel it. Nothing wrong with that. You're in a relationship with someone, and it's not what you thought it was going to be. It doesn't meet your needs, and so you break it off. Not anything wrong with that necessarily. It could be. You're married. 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And the relationship is no longer what you thought it would be. You didn't think this is how it would go. You thought that it was going to make you happy, and it's not. It's not the person you married, right? What obligation do I have to stay in this relationship that's not making me happy? You just cancel it. No obligation cancellation. You're a Christian. 5, 10, 20, 30 years. And then an event occurs that you could not have foreseen. Something happens that rocks the very foundation of your faith. A loved one dies. A child dies. A parent dies. You lose a job. Something goes horribly wrong. It's not how you expected it to go. God, that wasn't the deal. God, I thought you wanted to bless me. I thought we were on the same team. This isn't what I wanted. What do? Do you take the relationship in for an exchange? Do you cancel the service? Do you go elsewhere? A youth minister told me a story once. This young lady had graduated from the youth group and had moved off to college. And word got around to the youth minister that she had stopped going to church, really didn't want to have anything to do with God anymore. So he gave her a call just to kind of get her side of the story, see what was going on. And so he said, just talk to me. What happened? So she said, well, I mean, this problem occurred, having this problem, and it just doesn't seem like God wants to bless me anymore. It doesn't really seem like he and I are on the same team anymore. So he said, let me see if I got this right. As long as God blesses you, gives you what you want, and makes you happy, you'll love him and serve him. But as soon as God stops giving you what you want, as soon as things stop going your way exactly how you thought they would, you turn your back on him? And there was a pause, and he said, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said it like that. And she said, no, you're right. That's exactly what I'm doing. You see, she had adopted this free trial, no obligation cancellation policy when it came to her Christian faith. How many marriages end because the other partner no longer feels an obligation to uphold the covenant that they bound themselves to? How many Christians walk away from the faith because they no longer feel an obligation to uphold the terms of the covenant that they agreed to? And so I ask, what's the solution to this mindset? The solution has got to be endurance. Because not everything's going to go your way. Not everything is going to meet your needs. Not everything is going to be just wonderful all the time. You need endurance. James chapter 5, verse 11 provides a perfect example of endurance. James 5:11 says, "We count those blessed who endured." You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and merciful. So for a moment, just consider Job. Job lost all of his possessions. Job lost his entire family. He lost his health, his reputation. His wife turned on him. His best friends turned on him. And yet we consider him blessed. Why? Because he endured. Because not once did he turn his back on God. Never once. So, walk through that with me. We look at Job and everything that he went through, all that he lost. I don't think that any of us have experienced that magnitude of loss. So here's Job. He endures, and we say, attaboy, Job. That's the way to do it. That's the example, right there. And then when it comes to our own life, something happens, and we think, what was that, God? And you're not going to endure? So you watch Job and commend him, and then when it happens to you, you just forgot about it? Think about Job. Because I guarantee you, if you endure, you will be counted blessed. And how do I know that? How do we know that? It's because of the verse. You've seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings. You've seen it. You know that the Lord is compassionate. You know he's merciful. So endure. And aren't you glad that God doesn't take that kind of policy toward us? Right? Imagine if God took the free trial, no obligation, cancellation policy toward us. Right? As soon as he didn't get what he wanted, he just, I'll get another one. I'm so thankful that God endures with you and I. Is it too much to ask? Is it too much to ask for God to expect you to show the same level of commitment toward him as he does toward you? I don't think so. We must reject this no commitment attitude of an Amazon Prime world. We must endure. We started tonight talking about fish, and that despite being surrounded by salt water, he is able to filter that salt so that he is not salty on the inside. But you know, the same thing applies to boats, in a sense. A boat will never sink because of the water that's on the outside. Just think about it, right? A boat never sinks because of how much water is on the outside. A boat only sinks because the water gets on the inside. Same thing is true of our society. We will not stumble because of the world on the outside. We will stumble if the world gets in to us. The world becomes part of our inside. So let us not be polluted by the world. As long as we can filter it, as long as we can keep it from penetrating into our lives, we'll make it. We'll be successful. We'll be blessed. If we're generous, I believe we can filter out materialism. If we're patient, we can reject society's need for immediate gratification. If we are willing to undergo trials, then we can reject the priority that our society has placed on comfort. And if we endure, then we can reject the lack of commitment in our society. Let us be Christians in an Amazon Prime world.